I write comic books primarily. I never really wanted to do anything else. I didn't have a plan B. Worked a lot of jobs I didn't like. No formal education. I just read a lot and studied comics and learned the language of comics. And once I got a break, I just never left. I got hired by Larry Hama at Marvel. I had a lot of faith in myself. I had the mixture of ignorance and confidence that every creator needs. I proved my reliability, proved that I could keep my promises and meet deadlines, and I never looked back.
Welcome to the Thought Leader Revolution with Nikki Ballou. Join the revolution. There's never been a better time in history to speak your truth, find your freedom, and make your fortune. Each week, we interview the world's top thought leaders and learn the secrets of how they built a 6 to 7 figure practice. This episode has been brought to you by eCircleAcademy.com, the proven system to add 6 to 7 figures a year to your thought leader practice.
Welcome to another exciting episode of the podcast, The Thought Leader Revolution. I'm your host, Nikki Ballou. And boy, do we have a very special, very exciting guest lined up for you today. Today's guest is a legend in the comic book industry. He's a man who has been involved in some of the most iconic characters in comic book history, including my all-time favorite, Batman. He also has created his own company, and he's a best-selling author. I am speaking, of course, of none other than the one, the only, the legendary Chuck Dixon. Welcome to the show, Chuck.
Wow, what an intro. Now I have to live up to it.
There you go, man. There you go. You know, I copied Bruce Buffer. I don't know if you ever watch any UFC fights, but I love the way that guy introduces his fighters. So I just kind of copied him, copied his style. So there you go. So Chuck, really great to have you here. Let me tell you a little bit about my listener. My listener tends to be entrepreneurial, freedom-minded. They're the kind of person who's looking to take themselves to another level in life and in business. And like me, they tend to be of a libertarian bent. They believe in the promise of America and of freedom, free expression, free enterprise. They come here not because of me, because you know I'm here every week. They're here because of you. They want to learn from you, learn about you. Some of them probably know who you are, but a bunch of them won't. So why don't we start by you telling us your backstory? How'd you get to be the great Chuck Dixon?
I don't know. I write comics books primarily. I never really wanted to do anything else. I didn't have a plan B. I just aimed myself at working in the comic book industry. I've done it since I was a kid and worked a lot of jobs I didn't like. I got no formal education. I just read a lot. And studied comics and learned the language of comics and just kept at it until I got a break. And once I got a break, I just never left.
That's a good story. So tell us about your first break. How'd your first break happen and what was it?
Well, my first big break, I got two breaks simultaneously. It's like 1986, 1985, actually. I got hired to write Airboy, which was a regular feature at Eclipse Comics. And within 2 weeks, I got hired by Larry Hama at Marvel to write for Savage Tales and ultimately for Savage Sword of Conan. So I kind of got two breaks at the same time. And, I proved my reliability. You know, I proved that I could keep my promises and meet deadlines. And I never looked back.
That's amazing. That's amazing. I mean, having a dream from a young age and keeping at that dream is the key to success. A lot of people don't understand that. A lot of people go after something and, you know, when they hit a little bit of adversity, they quit. You know, what made you stick it out?
Well, I never wanted to do anything else. That was the problem. I sort of never prepared a backup plan. And what kept me going was that most comic books were really poorly written. And I just knew I could do a better job because I was really dedicated to the medium. I really, you know, I love the characters. You know, I love Batman. I love Spider-Man, all the rest of it. But what I really loved was the medium. I really loved this storytelling structure and the way it worked and this art form. And I just wanted to be in it. And I took every rejection notice as, I don't know what they're talking about. You know,
yeah.
I had a lot of faith in myself. I had the mixture of ignorance and confidence that every creator needs.
Amen. Amen. Every, you know, at some level, every entrepreneur is a creator as well. They're going to need that same mixture of ignorance and confidence. So,
and imagination, you have to see yourself in that place.
You do. Are you familiar with Steve Pressfield?
Yeah, the name rings a bell.
He wrote a bunch of pretty famous books. His most famous book was The Legend of Bagger Vance, which became a movie with Matt Damon and Will Smith. And then he wrote a bunch of books for artists. The first one was called The War of Art. And he goes on and he talks about what it takes to become successful as an artist, as a writer in particular. And one of the things that he talks about in his work is that if you want to succeed at your craft, you've got to find a way to put yourself in close proximity with where people do the kind of work that you want to do. He wrote a book about it called Put Your Ass Where Your Heart Wants to Be. <You know>? Great title for a book, right? So you got yourself your big break at Eclipse and at Marvel. So walk us through the story. What happened next for you?
Well, I kind of, you know, build a relationship. My main editor at Eclipse was Kat Ironwood. And, you know, I built a relationship with her. You know, I was in Pennsylvania. They were in California. This is all by phone. This is before email. Yeah. So, you know, and like I said, I proved my reliability. I proved that if I say it's going to be there on Friday, it's going to be there on Friday. If I say I can get this done by tomorrow, I got it done by the next day. So, you know, that's important. You know, when you're dealing with periodicals, they want the stuff on time. They've got to have content. And then after a while, Kat would, you know, turn to me and say, look, we need a 5-page story to fill out this issue of whatever. Yeah, I can do that. So I made myself the go-to guy. At Marvel with Larry, you know, it was harder to prove yourself because Larry had, you know, he set a really high bar and he put you through the acid test. You had to go through his, you know, test of fire. But once I did that and he realized that I was reliable, I was conscientious, I really cared about the quality of my work. And also I saw Conan and the other characters the same way he did. He couldn't do enough for me. I mean, he went to other editors at Marvel and said, you should hire this guy. You should use this guy. You know, he's really proven himself. So, you know, and from there, I just, you know, built relationships with various editors. And I always looked upon my editor, not as my boss, but as my partner. You know, we're working together to create a quality product. And if I ran into editors who weren't interested in a quality product, I didn't want to work with them.
Amen. So, I've seen that in the comic book industry, a lot of the better known names like yourself, Frank Miller, and so forth, seem to work at a lot of different comic book companies. So you've worked at Marvel, you've worked at DC, and, you know, from an outsider's point of view, those companies seem like they're blood enemies. They'd be at each other's throats. So how did all that work?
Well, I mean, that's a rivalry that they like to present as hostile, but it's never been that way. They realize they're both in the same business. Their successes rely upon one another. I mean, Marvel doesn't want to see DC go out of business anymore, and DC wants to see Marvel go out of business because they're kind of joined at the hip. Mm. And they exchange people all the time. I mean, you know, editors move back and forth. I mean, you know, Stan Lee and the guys at DC, they used to go out to dinner together, out to lunch together. So it really was a friendly rivalry. So yeah, there was never anything like, oh, you worked for Marvel, you can't work here. You know, if you were successful at one company, the other company wanted you as much as they could get out of you. That's why they always, I mean, DC cool. started a program of exclusives where you could only work for them. You go year by year. You know, just to hold on to you, because there was so much travel and back and forth between the two companies.
So when you were going through the ranks, what were some of your favorite experiences and what were some of your favorite characters that you really identified with or empathized with and enjoyed creating stories for?
Well, my favorite character will always be the Punisher. I had an affinity for Frank Castle. I don't know what that says about me. He's the only character that when I was, you know, wasn't right being paid the right stories for him anymore, I still think of Punisher stories. You know, it's hard to watch the news or read the newspaper and not think, hey, Frank Castle would fit in here. I mean, Frank Castle would be in Ukraine right now. There's things like that. So I, you know, those were great experiences. And then just getting to work on Batman was literally a dream come true. I mean, I never pitched for Batman. I never tried to write Batman. I got hired based on my writing on Airboy to come into the Batman offices. And I got a thrill every time I would type the words Batman and Robin.
No kidding, man. That's awesome stuff.
So cool. Which I'm grateful now that I can look back and realize I really did appreciate the opportunity. I took every advantage I could, and I really enjoyed every minute of writing Batman.
Batman is fantastic. I mean, I ordered one of your compilations of Batman and Wildcat, and I read the whole thing in an afternoon. It was so much fun. It was so much fun. It's a blast. So I wanted to get your thoughts on the comic book industry today. What's happened to the industry today compared to what it was like 10, 20, 30 years ago when you were, you know, working with Marvel and DC and coming up the ranks?
Well, it's pretty much, you know, it went into a doom spiral. It doesn't appear to be ending. Either company, they don't seem to be wising up to what's going on. And this pretty much started, you know, when the old guard editors like Larry Hama, Denny O'Neill, Archie Goodwin, when they retired, it was the end of an era. And they were replaced with editors who were largely indifferent to comics. They were looking to move on to other careers. They weren't lifers like comic book people used to be. You know, in my day, when you got into comics, that's what you wanted to do for the rest of your life. And these were people who I call tourists. And their indifference created a vacuum, and that vacuum left it open to activists getting hired at the company and then trying to basically turn Marvel and DC into propaganda mills for their own personal political agendas. And that's really when the wheels came off and the audience fled. And the level of craft declined in comics. For the most part, the output of DC and Marvel is way below par. There's some bright spots. There's some really talented people still working. But for the majority of the output they're doing, it's way below the expected level of quality that, you know, you and I wanted in a comic and expected in a comic decades
ago. It's interesting because I've noticed that, and I'm not really buying any of the comics that have been written in recent years. I'm buying old stuff, like your old stuff, Frank Miller's old stuff, Chris Claremont's old stuff. The new stuff is just some woke garbage. That's a hot mess and is doing a disservice to the industry. But it appears that a lot of good freedom loving Americans in a variety of industries seem to have either inadvertently or through carelessness allowed these activists to get into their institutions and march through their institutions and destroy them. One of the things that really upset me was seeing all these companies that used to be great, iconic American brands go completely woke. So I teamed up with a man named Wayne Allen Root, who is a conservative radio and television talk show host who's interviews Donald Trump a lot. And we wrote a couple of books basically to sound the alarm and to get people to stop going to these woke companies. So one of them was this one called The Great Patriot Protest and Boycott Book. It's a list of 116 woke companies and we told people to avoid him. And we took aim at Disney. And I don't want to say that, you know, we're the cause of it, but we certainly had a lot to do with raising the attention of what Disney was doing and getting people to turn away from that company.
Right.
And then we wrote this book called The Great Patriot Boycott Book, which is a list of non-woke companies. And right. one of them was Public Square, which now has thousands of non-woke companies on it. It got the attention of Donald Trump. He endorsed it, which was kind of nice. And all of that other good stuff. But you decided to do something to keep the flame of great storytelling in comics alive. Would you mind sharing with us that thought process and what you ended up doing?
Well, I mean, you know, back in the day, back in the 90s, you know, when comics were hot, and I was getting tons and tons of work. I was doing like, for a period, I was doing like 8 monthlies. You know, largely the editorial group and the freelancers, they're largely liberal. I'm not going to say leftist, they were liberal. I wasn't. But it didn't matter. It didn't matter back then. You know, we go to lunch, we go to dinner, we go to summits, and we'd argue politics and then go right back to work. You know, yeah. No harm, no foul. And, but that all changed. But, you know, I didn't want to stop working. So, you know, I self-published for a while and then moved into the crowdfunding sphere as crowdfunding and comics grew and the audience for crowdfunding grew. You know, it's basically like a second career. You know, it's a second resurgence of popularity for me, working in that sphere. And, you know, we're starting to see serious numbers as we serve the underserved comic book readership who have walked away entirely from DC and Marvel. They don't even pay attention anymore. And, you know, we're basically creating the kind of comics that they want and getting a lot of success for it.
You are. I bought a couple of them and I've read them. They're a lot of fun. They're like the old fashioned stories. They're great. And tell me about the company. Tell me about the vision that you have for it and where you see it going over the next few years.
Well, I mean, I work for a variety of guys, you know, Graham Nolan. I'm currently writing a follow up to our Joe Frankenstein. Graham runs Compass Comics, him and his wife, Julie, run Compass Comics. I've been doing a lot of work recently for Eric July with the Riververse Comics. Eric's kind of the new crowdfunding king. We recently did a you know, $1.3 million crowdfunding campaign for a comic that I wrote. And I've written 3 more projects for him that'll come out, you know, throughout the rest of the year. But he's had enormous success, and he gets good numbers. I mean, he gets numbers. He's getting DC and Marvel numbers on the trade paperbacks. He doesn't publish comic books. He publishes, you know, trade paperbacks. These things are 100 pages plus, and he's getting terrific numbers. And you know, there's other people, you know, in the business as well. Richard Meyer and Billy Tucci and Brian Polito and people like that who are having tremendous success reaching out to the comic book public, you know, the comic book readership. Who are, you know, frankly frustrated with the big two companies.
As it should be. So, yeah. So I picked up a copy of this book just recently. It's tell me about this and how'd this come about?
Well, I mean, it was largely my wife kept saying, you know, you should think about writing ebooks. I'm like, well, I'm not a prose guy. I'm a comic book writer. I've never wanted to be a novelist, but you know, I wasn't getting as much comic book work. And she kept saying, there's money here. There's money to be made. You would own it, you know, entirely. So I did it. I got into ebook publishing and I did well for a while till Amazon started goofing around with the algorithms. And eventually I had to go over to a publisher, but the Levon Cade books, Levon Trades is the first one. You know, it's you know, vigilante justice action stuff. It's like the adventure paperbacks of the 70s. I like to think it's a little more grounded in reality. It scratches my Punisher itch. And it all paid off because, you know, in a few weeks, they start filming the adaptation of Levon's Trade with Jason Statham. So...
Buddy, that's fantastic. Congratulations.
Yeah. Screenplay by Sylvester Stallone. David Ayer is directing it. The guy that directed Fury. So yeah, I'm pretty excited.
And those guys, Jason Statham and Sylvester Stallone, are not activists. They're actually good old fashioned regular actors. And if you get in their face too much, they'll knock you on your keister. So God bless them both. I love them.
They are plain talking guys.
Plain talking guys. Well said. No, well said. I really enjoyed watching Tulsa Kings. I thought that was a lot of fun. I don't know if you saw that.
So that was awesome. That was awesome.
It's really good.
There's so much of Sly in that story. I mean, I've been working with Sly for a number of years, and you get to know, you look in his work and you see, yeah, that's a lot of him there. So yeah. he brings more. He just doesn't act in projects. He brings his whole creative, force to everything he works on. The guy's a workaholic, man. He's a total stud.
He is a total stud. And look at what kind of shape he's in, man. You know, I'm 56. I think I'm in decent shape, but man, compared to him, I got a ways to go.
Yeah. I'm a few years behind him, and I wish I looked like that at 30.
Straight up. That's awesome. That's awesome. So, if I were to ask you to give some advice to my listener about how to be successful in the face of this modern onslaught by the left and the cultural Marxists trying to shut us up, what would your advice be?
Well, first of all, they haven't won. I get people ask me all the time, when is the woke era going to be over? And I was thinking the other day, did it ever really begin? Because no one bought it. I mean, outside of Barbie, there's no woke movie that made any money.
Yep.
And Barbie, they had to cover it all up in pastel, goofiness to sell it. But there's no, you think of all these woke movies they made, all the movies they made that were like against the Iraq War, and all these movies they make that are all about race controversies and things like, they don't make any money. Nobody wants to see that. Nobody gives a crap about that stuff. And they're finally learning of this after they've gone tens of billions of dollars in debt. Some of these studios are teetering on the brink of bankruptcy because of these stupid decisions. And I realized, the woke era never really started because everybody rejected it. The majority rejected it. And, to be successful now, you just have to find those people that rejected it. And there's lots of them. I mean, there's a ready audience for this stuff. And we see it over and over. I mean, the Daily Wire has had tremendous success.
They have. I love Lady Ballers. Did you see that? That was fun.
I haven't seen it, but I mean, they're...
You got to see it, man. You got to see it. It's so good.
I mean, I saw Run, Hide, Fight. I saw the Western they made with Gina Carano. It's like, these are real movies. These are really, this is good stuff. And they've been successful. Other people have been successful. I've been successful. And I really think that this madness is coming to an end, except at Disney. Disney just seems to keep doubling down for whatever reason.
I think that there's going to be a time where they're going to have to stop doubling down because they've lost over $100 billion in their market cap, and that is not sustainable. That's not even for Disney. Nobody can lose $100 billion in
Their board structure is so weird, and I don't know why the shareholders haven't just said no, enough of this. Apparently there's a fight coming. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I'm rooting for the side of the good guys of light and right, because in my opinion, America in a way is God's light to the world. The United States of America is the only nation in the history of the world that was conceived in the idea that men could live free, and that they did not need a tyrant overseeing every little aspect of their lives.
Right. And
unfortunately, when there's light, darkness inevitably wants to intrude, and the forces of evil, the forces of the devil, quite frankly, have been attempting for over 100 years to topple America. And they've had some success in marching through the institutions and in doing what they do. But when I see men like you stand up against these guys and go out there and do your own thing and still stand up for the purity of the American ideal in your work. And I know perhaps you don't on a daily basis speak about this in this fashion, but that's really what you're doing. You're standing up for traditional American artists who loved America, who loved everything she was about, and wanted to tell stories that would, in a wonderful way, capture the imagination of the public and show them that, hey, these stories represent the best of our ideals, the best of the American ideal. And I think it's awesome that you're doing what you're doing. I'm going to buy everything you've ever done. It might take me a while, but that's my plan. That's my way of supporting you. And I want to tell my listeners to do the same. I bought a whole bunch of your stuff, and I'm in the process of plowing through it and reading it. And I want to see you keep doing what you're doing. And brother, if you've got folks that are like you, I want to meet them. I want to bring them on my show.
I'll definitely hook you up with some awesome people to talk to.
I'd love that. I'd love that. And, you know, John Delarose, he's great. I bought a bunch of his stuff. He's come on the show. He writes for PJ Media. My good friend who used to be the founder of PJ Media, actually still is the founder, but he doesn't work there anymore. His name is Roger Simon. He's come on the show. He was a liberal who got mugged by reality after 9/11, and he's he's no longer a liberal. He was never a leftist to begin with. And I want to meet more of these people, and let's tell their stories. And I'm excited about the movie coming out with Jason Statham. God bless me. When it's coming out, let me know. I'd love to interview him. Love to interview you. Love to interview the director, the producer, all those guys. It'd be okay. Phenomenal. And I'll be happy to introduce you to Wayne Allen Root. He's got a really big TV show on Real America's Voice Network. I think he'd love to have you on. His producer is a good friend of mine, Andrew Paul.
Okay. Yeah. Anytime. Yeah. Yeah.
Chuck,
yeah, I'll hook you up with some comic career. I mean, you need to talk to Graham Nolan, man. He's like a, him and his wife have built this comic company on their own, and he's a force to be reckoned with. So
I'd love to meet him. Love to talk to him. And listen, I got an idea for you. So my buddy Roger Simon, he's keen on writing some really cool stories from the past. And it just hit me now. He's been trying to turn them into movies. You know, he's got to raise a $30 million to do that. But maybe you could take a version of it and turn it into a comic book. And I'll tell you what it is offline, because I don't want everybody to know about it. Somebody else to beat us on the march. But it's a phenomenal story. And maybe I connect you with Roger, because, you know, he was an Academy Award nominated screenwriter before Hollywood stopped hiring him when they went completely crazy.
Well, a lot of movie projects start out as comics, as we know. I mean, I've done a number of turned movie treatments into comics. So, you know, it helps raise investor money.
You know, that is a fantastic point. Thank you for making it. Yeah. Chuck, God bless you, man. Thanks for doing what you do. I will make some connections on the back end with you and some of the folks I know to get you on some other shows. And please introduce me to Graham and other folks in the industry.
Absolutely.
And let's rock and roll. I'll send you my personal cell number. Let's stay in touch. I love what you're doing, and I want to continue to support you with it in lots and lots of different ways.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Yeah,
you bet. So listen, if somebody's interested in, you know, buying your stuff, is there a place where you have all of it? Is there a place they can engage with you? Do you have a list communicate with? What's the best way for them to like get connected with you?
I'm on Facebook. I'm on X. You can go on Amazon, put my name in. I have a weekly show called Ask Chuck Dixon on YouTube. So, you know, just plug my name into YouTube. It'll take you to my channel. And I mean, there's plenty of ways to reach out to me.
Okay, we'll make sure we put all of those in the show notes, and we'll get that going. So, Chuck, we finish off by asking you as our guest expert for your top three expert action steps. These are your three best pieces of life, business, career advice for my listener in bullet point form to help them elevate themselves to the next level. So what do you say?
Well, I mean, just from my own experience, never apologize for your work. You know, never say, oh, I wasn't feeling well when I wrote this or wasn't it. No, this is the best thing you've ever read, even if you don't believe it yourself. You never apologize for your own work. My other one is don't get involved in office politics. I never did that. I was always like, I don't care. I don't care who hates who, who's talking about who, who's cheating on who. I don't want to hear it. I don't want to know about it. I'm just about the work. And the other one is try to be the go-to guy. Whatever job you have, whatever you're going for, you want to be the most important person there. You want to be the person they turn to in an emergency. And I was always that every company I ever worked for. You know, we need a script by tomorrow. Okay, I can do it. I'll stay up all night, but I can do it. And that way you make yourself irreplaceable.
Yeah. You know what? I think I might call this episode How to Make Yourself Irreplaceable. I think that is a great, great title for this episode. Chuck Dixon, thanks for coming on. Real pleasure, real honor to have you here. God bless you.
A lot of fun talking to you. Thank you.
Absolutely. And that wraps up another exciting episode of the podcast, The Thought Leader Revolution. To find out more about today's incredible guest, the legendary, one and only Chuck Dixon, go to the show notes at thethoughtleaderrevolution.com or wherever you listen to this episode, be it iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, Audible, or what have you. Until next time, goodbye.
This episode has been brought to you by eCircleAcademy.com, the proven system to add 6 to 7 figures a year to your thought leader practice.